Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 167 of the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Now occasionally we do profiles, we take a full episode of the podcast to profile a very significant and interesting person from the world of cars. Often they'll be the founders, as it is this week. Where we've chosen the founder of Lotus, Colin Chapman. this is hopefully a thorough, detailed biography of the man, because he was a fascinating character, and he lived a really remarkable life, achieved extraordinary things on the road car side and in motorsport, of course, as well. So hopefully it's an interesting episode. Enjoy it. Let us know. But before we get stuck in, I will just remind you all to rate and review the podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, if you listen most weeks, please just give it a review, give it a rating. It really helps. And while you're doing that, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button. That's basically how we find a bigger audience. So it's really important, and it also means you don't miss a single episode. So please do that and enjoy this one. Thank you. He was known as Colin Chapman, but actually his full name was Anthony Colin Bruce Chapman. And if you look at the Lotus logo, actually, I've long wondered what those letters stood for, and only researching this morning did I realise his name wasn't just Colin Chapman, it was Anthony Colin Bruce Chapman. So you do see the ACBC in the logo.
Yeah, you do.
Which is, so that's his full name. Now, we want to give a full picture of this man, don't we?
Yeah.
And there's no doubt he was a genius and a pioneer, but we're not going to pretend he was an angel. And there's some interesting sides to his story that we are going to touch on.
There's a book by a motoring journalist called Mike Lawrence.
Yes, I saw.
Which is, have you seen it? It's quite a sort of, what's the word? He doesn't hold back.
Yes.
if you want a sort of a very colourful description of the man and his achievements and everything else. The reason I mention it is it's called Wayward Genius,
yeah,
which I think is about as good a description of Chapman as you'll ever come across. Yeah, I mean, an amazing man. Mm. What's your take on where the word Lotus came from? Or can't we talk about it on this podcast?
I think we're going to mention it. So, as far as I understand, the exact reason died with Chapman. Well, no one knows, and he never confirmed exactly why he called it Lotus. But the story that I read was that he called his then-girlfriend, later wife, Hazel, Lotus Blossom. So yeah. It was an affectionate nickname, and
yes,
he just purloined it.
There are so many rumours that swirl about. A few of them have something to do with as you say, his then girlfriend, then wife, not all to do with Lotus Blossom. But it's interesting, isn't it, that you name a car company and nobody actually ever knows
why.
What the but I think that's just the sort of thing that sort of adds to the the mystique of the mare.
Yeah, it does. And that's right, and hopefully in this episode we'll tell you a few things about Colin Chapman that you didn't know before. And why are we doing this now? Because it's this year, it's 75 years since Chapman built his very first car.
Yes.
This was before Lotus. However, yeah. Lotus cars and the Lotus Formula One team, they have their origins in that very first car, the Mark One, he called it, that he designed and built in 1948. So this was 4 years before he even
found it was a
Lotus.
Modified.
Yes,
he modified. It was an Austin 7 trials car.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's where it all comes from. Most things, it all comes from somewhere. I mean, the first car that Ferrari built wasn't called a Ferrari. It was called an Auto Avia Costruzione or something, which was made in 1940. But, you know, that's in all but name, that's the first Ferrari. And that Mark I was the first Lotus. And it's interesting, all this stuff going on at the moment. There's 75 years of Porsche and 75 years of Goodwood. And there's some big McLaren Avia. Nobody seems to be talking about 75 years of Lotus.
No. Well, I guess maybe they're waiting for... I mean, the company was founded in 1952, wasn't it?
I guess.
So perhaps that's the anniversary. But this is as good a time to do it as any, because as you say, everything Lotus has done ever since has its origins in that little Austin 7, that modified Austin 7 that he built in 1948. And he built it in just a garage, like a lockup, belonging to his girlfriend's parents. And it was... it used... a composite made of thin aluminium bodywork bonded to plywood. As you say, it was a trials car, and he competed in it with some success. And he did so with his then girlfriend Hazel. And we've mentioned Hazel already a few times because actually she's quite important to the Colin Chapman and the Lotus story. And this is from Lotus's own website. To describe her as merely Colin Chapman's wife is to do her an incredible disservice. In reality, she was the co-founder of Lotus, a successful racing driver, a shrewd businesswoman, and the rock upon which the Lotus foundations have been solidly built. She also provided the first loan that Chapman used to found Lotus Engineering in 1952. And actually, she lived on until 2 years ago.
I was going to say, I thought she only died a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
She must have made a fine old age. She must have, because she would have been born in the 20s.
Yeah, I think well into her 90s.
Yeah.
A good old innings, that one. So that's why we're doing this now. That Mark I is 75 years old this year. So let's go all the way back, though. Colin Chapman, born 19th May 1928 in Richmond, London. And he studied structural engineering at University College London. Then joined the RAF on national service. He also, while at university, joined the London Air Squadron and learned to fly. So it's really important that he had this sort of background in aviation, because that's
particularly
where,
from an aerodynamics point of view
and materials as well.
And
that's where he started working with aluminium. And even in his very earliest days, perhaps even when he was still a teenager, he was working with aluminium and realizing the benefits of lightweighting and lightweight materials.
And also, it
which
was
is
a
just
very
so key to the Lotus story, isn't it?
It was a very fortuitous time.
Yes.
To do that. I mean, the reason that Land Rovers run up to when the old Defender went out of production in 2015, 2016 were aluminium. Was there was just so much of the stuff knocking about from scrapped military machines after the war. And so it was the natural material to use. So many people used it, not because it was light or because it was corrosion resistant. They used it because it was just cheap and about. It was abundant. And Chapman took it and put it to purposes which had never been used to before.
There's something about the perfectly fortuitous timing of Colin Chapman's birth that I think we have to address. Had he been born, I don't know, 10 years earlier, he'd have been enlisted in the war, wouldn't he? And who knows what might have become of him.
But also, he existed in a time in motoring. Can you imagine if he was, I don't know, 30 now, presented with a rule book as it is?
Well,
I think it would have driven him up the wall.
Quite right.
It was a time when true innovation.
Yeah.
You know, advantages weren't gained by tiny, tiny, sometimes invisible little changes here and there, and myriad, hundreds of thousands, which all together add up to a few tenths. He could make a completely different sort of, you know, he made a car with a gas turbine engine, cars with four-wheel drive, Formula One racing cars. A lot of his stuff didn't work, but it was, he was around at a time where he could give complete freedom to his extraordinarily creative mind and his engineering talent. And you're absolutely right. Actually, I think also if he'd been around that much earlier and he'd been doing this before the war, the materials wouldn't have been there, the technology wouldn't have been there. I think he wouldn't have found it frustrating because he wouldn't have known any better, but I think he wouldn't have made the advances that he went on to make at any other time other than the period in which he lived.
That's right. And actually, Formula One was sort of a bit of a boys' club then, and it wasn't the multi-billion dollar industry it is today. So it was more accessible for a small outfit like Lotus. And as you say, in hindsight, some of the earlier things that he did were obvious. Lightweighting, we just take that for granted now. But it wasn't being done in Formula One back then. And some of the other innovations we'll come to, like a monocoque. I mean, that wasn't the first monocoque car, the Lotus 25. But no one had done it in Formula One racing before.
Nobody had done it in Formula One, yeah.
So he... the opportunity was almost begging, wasn't it? And he was the one who did it. But let's not skip ahead too far. So after the Mark 1 came the Mark 2. And actually, he numbered his cars numerically. Mark was replaced by Type later on. And even in those early years, he was starting to build these... they were racing cars, really, to begin with. And they were popular, and there was enough demand to build dozens of these cars. And then in 1957, it was the Lotus 7. And that's where things really took off. And, of course, it's the Lotus 7 that we still know today as the Caterham 7. And his cars were lighter, smaller, nimbler than the competition. They had better handling. They certainly were not just about more power.
Can I just give a... Yeah, well, exactly. Can I just give a shout-out to... a few others. There was you're talking about him using Mark, then later Type. I actually think he used Roman numerals up until about the Mark 9. And I think the first car to actually call itself a Lotus was the Mark 3, which was his first sort of circuit racer. The Lotus 6 is an incredibly important. If you look at it, you'll see a Lotus 7. And the 7 was quite different under the skin. But that design, that sort of sports racer design, which frankly is still being made by Caterham today.
Yeah.
So the 6, which came out in 52, I think, is an incredibly important car. And cars like the 8 and the 9 were the cars that really established Lotus as a presence on the racetrack. These were very, very streamlined. I think he was using Frank Costin by then, who'd been working for de Havilland. So, you know, another reason for him to be thankful for his apprenticeship in the Air Force. And then, of course, from a road car point of view, the 7 came along. And what he would do is, the kit cars were nothing new when the 7 came along, but what he would sell you the kit, but it would have all the bits in it. So I think with things like the 6 and also other kit cars, you know, you not only had to source your own engine, you had to get your own gearbox, you had to go and get your own axles, that sort of thing. And although the Lotus kit cars were more expensive, I think it was about something like 500 quid for a 7, which doesn't sound like much now, does it? But back then it was a lot of money. That got you everything. That got you your engine, your gearbox, your suspension, full kit. Like they do today. And he reckoned that you could turn that kit into a car over a weekend.
Really? Blimey.
Yeah. Yeah. Tried to do it. I mean, this is jumping ahead a bit. In 1992, me and a few mates, James May being one of them, we got a Caterham kit on a Friday evening with the aim of driving a car out of the shed where we built it on a Monday morning. It didn't quite happen like that because it was, they didn't supply all the bits. But anyway, what we did create, which was almost all the car, went back to Caterham, and we were told that it was the worst built car that they'd ever seen, which we were quite proud of. But anyway, that's an aside.
We did something similar at Evo a few years ago, actually. A few of us were tasked with throwing this thing together. None of us had any clue what we were doing. I think we probably got a third of the way through. It went back to Caterham, and they finished it, or probably restarted it and then finished it.
Yeah, I think the car, because the car we built, I ran as my long term for 6 months. And I think a clutch cable went, and that was it. And we did whatever it was. I did, you know, five figure sum of miles in it. Drove it all around France, everything. Never went wrong. So they must have rebuilt it. Because if the car we built, we've done that, it wouldn't have gone off the end of the drive.
No, exactly.
Yes. Anyway, so we digress. Yeah, the 7, I mean, I think we know the story. I mean, it's probably worth dwelling on a little bit because it's almost exactly 50 years ago that Colin Chapman absolutely bored with the 7, which by then was already a 15-year-old car, and he wanted to take his road car business into a much higher and mighty place, sold the rights and the jigs and the production tooling and everything else to a bloke called Graham Nern, who was a Lotus dealer down in Caterham. And Caterham Cars was created then. And we will see at the Festival of Speed, when is it, in a couple of weeks' time, this new Caterham 5, the super streamlined EV Caterham vision of the future. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? You know, you get something like that and you trace it back, and it still all ultimately comes down to Colin designing the Lotus 7 in the late 1950s.
Yeah, it does. And actually the 7 really typified what Lotus was about then, and to some extent at least continues to be about now. Lighter, smaller, nimbler, better handling, not about power. He's famously quoted as saying, adding power makes you faster on the straights, subtracting weight makes you faster everywhere. And it, again, blindingly until obvious
something falls,
now.
Until something falls off it.
Oh, God, that's a whole other matter, isn't it?
Which it did.
It's blindingly obvious now, but it still took someone to actually put that logic into practice, and Chapman was the man. Yeah, I mean, you're right about reliability and cars braking, particularly in racing. We'll come back to some of those a little bit later on. But first, I want to discuss... Go on.
So I was just going to say the 7. I mean, it was so successful, it was so good, that in club racing, there would be clubs that just wouldn't have them anymore because there was no point, because if people knew they were going to be 7s racing, they just wouldn't bother to turn up. And so Lotus then were able to make this big noise, publicity noise about so fast it's been banned from racing, too fast to race, which was brilliant for it. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, love them.
Well, let's talk about Colin Chapman, the driver.
Yeah.
Because he was a very skilled driver himself. And he, certainly at sort of club level, even in his very earliest days when he was doing trials and the circuit racing, he was very competitive, won plenty of races. He entered one Formula One Grand Prix.
Yeah, I discovered this today.
Same.
I would have thought this is something that I'd have known, but it was literally while researching this. And he binned it in practice.
He did. The 1956...
Into his teammate, I think.
He did. The 1956 French Grand Prix at Reims. He was driving a Van Wall. And Mike Hawthorne was his teammate in a similar Van Wall. And he did manage to qualify. He qualified fifth ahead of Mike Hawthorne. Ahead of Stirling Moss.
Did he qualify?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he did. I think it was later in the session... that he, you're right, he crashed at the hairpin. He locked a brake and hit Hawthorne, his teammate, and Chapman's car was damaged beyond repair, which is why he never started the Grand Prix. Hawthorne, they repaired his car and he did race. But I've checked several different websites, including other reliable ones. He qualified fifth ahead of Mike Hawthorne.
And he was in a Van Wall because Lotus was responsible for developing the chassis of the Van Wall. Van Wall famously being the first British car company to win the Constructors' Championship. In fact, it won the inaugural Constructors' Championship. And I don't think that people necessarily appreciate Colin's role in all that. But he was an amazing driver. If you go on YouTube, there is a one-mate race where they got all the team managers. Do you know about this?
Yes, I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah.
What were they in? Was it Cortina's?
I think it was Cortina's.
Yeah.
Or was it Cortinas? Was it Escorts?
Oh, maybe it was.
I think there might have been Escort. I got so long since I've seen it, I can't remember. But anyway, go on it. And he's up there and he's duffing up Jack Brabham. I mean, it is extraordinary. would he have been Jim Clark good? Probably not. And certainly he was far too valuable a resource designing cars, A, for him not to be distracted by racing them, but also in that era to risk the chance of something awful happening.
Yeah.
So he stopped.
So a heck of a driver. And I think maybe we should just mention Jim Clark, because this fits in quite nicely. Now, the Jim Clark, Colin Chapman thing, again, that relationship is absolutely integral to the story of Chapman, the story of Lotus. They first met on Boxing Day 1958 when Jim Clark entered a race at Brands Hatch driving a Lotus Elite. Now, Colin Chapman was in that race driving a Lotus Elite. Chapman won ahead of Clark. There you go. I mean, that was a young, inexperienced Jim Clark, but you don't beat Jim Clark in the same car without being a heck of a driver. I found this wonderful extract from a story that Colin Chapman wrote about Jim Clark. And I think it's worth just reading some of it now, because it gives you an idea of how they met and why Colin Chapman thought so much of this young Scottish racing driver. He wrote, "The first I ever heard of Jim Clark was from Jock McBain, who had been purchasing Lotus sports cars from us for 2 or 3 years. He mentioned this young farmer, already legendary up in the borders, whom he felt was a very, very good driver. One of the first occasions I really met Jimmy was when he came down to Brands Hatch to try out a Formula 2 car on behalf of Border Reavers, who were thinking of purchasing one. There and then, I was most impressed with the way he drove the car, especially as it was his first single-seater drive and also his first drive at Brands Hatch. He was steady, consistent, and basically just downright competent. At around the same time, he drove a Lotus Elite for the Border Reavers team at Le Mans, doing very well indeed, and my impression of his performance then was reinforced when he drove at Brands Hatch one Boxing Day in an Elite." Now, he very sort of coquettishly here says, I drove in that same race. He doesn't mention that he won it. He just says, I drove in that same race, and we had quite a dice together. Immediately afterwards, I asked him if he would like to join Team Lotus. This was during the period when Team Lotus was in a stage of transition from being a racing team in which I was the principal driver and thus was virtually being run for my benefit, to the point where I was sponsoring a team for other drivers. This transition therefore coincided with Jimmy coming to Lotus, and therefore he was the first driver to actually come to the team as its principal driver. So we really came of age together. Lotus was just getting into Grand Prix racing. Jimmy was just getting into Grand Prix racing. The fact, therefore, that we were both learning together made our association very interesting and so very fruitful.
Oh, there you go.
And we can talk a bit more about what they achieved together. But just before we do that, this is what Chapman said about Jim Clark after he died. "He will always be the best. I'm sure in time someone else will come along and everyone will hail him as the greatest ever, but not for me. For me, there will never be another in Jimmy's class."
It's quite something, isn't it? It's quite something. I mean, it's so often, isn't it, that you need, I think, I'm in no way comparing Verstappen to Jim Clark, because I don't believe you can compare drivers from across the eras, but the magic tends to come when you get two geniuses. So you get Verstappen and a Newey together.
Yeah.
Or a Clark and a Chapman. And also, I think the other thing was that it just happened at the right time, because Jim Clark was a great, great driver in the early 1960s, but he wasn't sort of revered in the early part of his Formula One career. I guess because Stirling was still there. Mm. I mean, let's not forget that the first person to win a Formula One race in a Lotus, it wasn't Jim Clark, it was Stirling Moss in a private car. So Stirling Moss won a Formula One race in a Lotus before anybody from Lotus did. But when Jimmy came good, and again, I think it's so often, isn't it, that you need the right tool for the job. And for Jimmy, that was the Lotus 25, which you mentioned earlier. And the combination of car and driver. And the only thing, and the only reason he didn't, well, it's ridiculous to think that, okay, he sadly died long, long, long before his time. But nevertheless, his Formula One career was probably, well, he was certainly racing in 60 and he died in 68. So it was at least 9 seasons there. Only won 2 championships. If the cars he'd been driving had held up more often, no one would have been able to touch him.
Mm.
And, you know, it's like in 62, it's ridiculous. He had a revolutionary racing car. He was, by then, the greatest driver on the grid. Didn't win the championship. Because the car just broke too often. And I think it's, you know, 67. Lotus 49 comes along. Another complete, everybody else thinking, oh my God, our cars are obsolete as of this moment. Because this Lotus 49 comes up with, Lotus 49 comes out with not just a fully stressed engine, which had actually happened before with the Lotus 43, but that had a terrible 816 BRM engine in it. But the DFV, this production specification, short, stiff, strong V8. And again, he didn't win the championship. It's funny, isn't it? And, you know, and you just think, how many championships did Lotus not win because of Chapman's obsession with lightweighting and cutting corners? I think he once said, this might be apocryphal, might not, but I think he once said that the perfect mass for a car is a car that is so light that it completely falls to bits the moment it crosses the finishing line.
Yeah. Which is actually asking for trouble, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. It's cutting the margins so far that, particularly back then, when tolerances aren't what they are today, when metallurgy wasn't what it was, and there were some big accidents. A lot of people died in Lotus cars. Actually, not that many, because through failure of the Lotus cars. You know, you think of Ronnie Peterson's death in 1978. That had nothing to do with the car. But quite often, you look at Stirling Moss's accident at Spa in 1960. A wheel came off the car. There was a hub failure. And when they looked at the other cars, they discovered that they all had hub failures too. It was just, you know, Stirling broke his back, his nose, his legs, and everything in that crash. And it was just providence which allowed him to keep going. The crash, his Goodwood crash in 1962. Now, nobody knows the cause, and, you know, but I think because it was Stirling, because of where it was on the track, it seems so utterly implausible that Stirling made a mistake. So it was one of two things. It was either Graham Hill, who was overtaking at the time, moving over on him and putting him on the grass. Sadly, the footage isn't good enough to determine that. Or something went wrong with the car. So, yeah, anyway. So the whole lightweighting thing, I mean, I think it's one of those things, is it's one of those principles that no principle is indefinitely extendable. So it's not always, without exception, a good idea to make your car lighter.
There's a point.
And Chapman reached and passed that point.
Yes.
To his own detriment.
Gosh. There's no question about that. But in other ways, in another sense, his fanatical approach to lightweighting paid dividends. And during the 60s and 70s, Lotus was perhaps the force. Do you think the force in Formula One?
It certainly had that potential. But as I think I say, too often other teams were allowed to get in. I mean, I think a team like, particularly in the early 70s, Tyrrell comes along. A very, very professionally run outfit. No Jim Clark anymore, and you've got a Jackie Stewart. And cleverly designed car with a great driver and a very, very good team. I think they had the potential to be absolutely unbelievable, but it was actually up there. They were probably the team to beat, because Ferrari were completely off the boil by then. Ferrari didn't win a championship between 64 and 75. But other ones, you know, Brabham won one in 67, and then, Jackie Stewart with the Tyrrell in 69 and in 71 and in 73, and McLaren started coming along with Emo in 74. They did win in 1970, but they lost the driver when Jochen Rindt had that brake failure at Monza in 1970. So, yeah, I mean, often when I think about it, I look at all they achieve, and there's a bit of me which goes on to wonder how much more even than that they could have achieved if they just made the cars a little bit more robust.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So just for the sake of getting on record, Team Lotus won 7 F1 Constructors titles and 6 Drivers' Championships between 62 and 78, and the Indy 500 as well during that
year. Yeah, let's not forget.
Amazing.
Yeah, and Indy cars had all been these very traditional front-engine cars, and obviously all American with... amazingly powerful but very basic four-cylinder engines. Colin went over there, well, he went over there with a gas turbine car, which didn't win. I think Graham Hill raced that and it broke. But then, you know, he was the first person to take a mid-engine car to Indy. Mm. And it's 65 after a couple of attempts. Jim Clark and Lotus won the Indy 500. So, yeah, amazing.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of the specific cars and some of the innovations, because that really is what you want to discuss when talking Chapman. So the Lotus 25, the first monocoque F1 car?
Yeah, it was the first monocoque, but we have to be quite precise about that, don't we? Because it wasn't the first monocoque car.
No.
Because that was the Lancia Lambda back in 1922, and it wasn't the first monocoque racing car, because Jaguar D-Types had a form of monocoque back in the 50s. I think some people call it a semi-monocoque. But yes, it was the first one which, instead of having a sort of spindly space frame, which you just bolted bodywork to, used the body itself as a structural member, with the result that the car was, it was just better in every way. It was stiffer, it was stronger, it was lighter, it was better.
Yeah.
And everything else was obsolete from that moment onwards. And that was the Lotus 25, which won the championship in, well, actually ultimately in 63. And then again... Yeah, as a Lotus 33, although that was just an Evolve 25, again with Jim Clark in 65.
And what about mid-engine? I don't think Lotus were necessarily the first to do that in F1, but among
Cooper
the first.
Did it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, Cooper were doing it in the late 50s. No, they were. I mean, so the first Lotus to race in a Formula One race wasn't a Formula One car. That was the Lotus 12, and I actually wrote it down here somewhere. Yeah, it's the 12 was his first single seater, and then he did the 16, which was designed to do, which was again another front engine car. But by that stage, the 16 came along in 58. But Cooper were making, you know, Cooper were making mid engine cars and winning races with mid engine cars by then. So the first mid engine car was the 18, and the 18 was, it's an amazing car, but it is the car in which. Sterling had that enormous accident at Spa in. It was an 18-21. It's sort of like a hybrid between the 18 and its successor that Sterling had his crash in. The 18 was the car that Alan Stacey died in at Spa in 1960, although I think all the reports say that he was hit by a bird, so you can hardly blame the car for that. But it was unbelievably light. I think in Formula Junior specification, because quite often what you do with these cars is someone would buy a kit and you could stick a... different engines in it. You could put a Formula One engine in it, or you could put a smaller engine in it and go and could race in the same car in Junior Formula. I think in Formula Junior specification, it weighed about 770 pounds. Oh. Now, I'm not good enough to do the conversion, but there's a great book called Lotus Series 2. And it's talking about the 18, and they give the highest and the lowest weight, and it's 770 to 980.
So I've just checked, 770 pounds is 349 kilograms, which is extraordinarily light for a motor vehicle. That's astonishing.
That's ridiculous, yeah. Anyway, there you go.
It's not just mechanical engineering at Lotus. There was an awful lot of innovative aerodynamics work going on as well.
Yeah.
Which ones do we need to... I mean, clearly the Lotus 79, the ground effect car with the skirts...
Well, I mean, before that, there was the 72,
yep.
Which was one of the longest-lived Formula One cars. So it made its debut in 1970. It was still winning races in 74. It raced in 75, finally uncompetitive. This is just a really simple, clever thing, was he moved the radiators.
Mm.
They used to be stuck out the front where the air was. And he moved them to the sides of the car. So the radiators were inside the wheelbase. So, I mean, that had two effects. One is it massively reduced the frontal area of the car. And it also meant you could do more with the front end of the car in terms of the aero. But also it centralized the mass of those radiators. He just stole a march on everybody else. And I think the other thing that you need to consider with Chapman is that certainly... I mean, something like the 25 was a pure Chapman car. But obviously, as is the way with all Formula One designs, we think of today's Red Bull, RB, whatever it is, and think that's a Newey car. Well, he's not the bloke who just sits there and does the whole thing.
No.
And increasingly, and particularly when you get towards the ground effect era, I think it was Peter Warren, Peter Wright, Colin would have had absolute sign-off of these things, but he didn't design them himself. Mm. Mm. Anymore. But what he would have done is recognised the innovations that they represented. And you know, something like ground effect, so where you basically turn, you know, you seal the car to the deck using skirts, and then you use the entire body and the underside of the car as a wing.
Mm.
And you get this thing called ground effect, which essentially sucks the car onto the surface of the ground. And if you've got that, and nobody else does, as he did... The Lotus 78 in 1977 had a bit of it, but the car that was kind of like the first proper ground effect car was the 79. And if you've got that, which they had in 1978, again, it was a Lotus 25, a Lotus 49, a Lotus 72 moment. Everybody else just thinks... Oh, bloody hell, we better go away and design one of these.
Mm.
And so the 78 won the champion. Sorry, the 79 won the championship in 1978 with Mario Andretti driving, despite the fact that they didn't finish a lot of races. Mm. I'm not even sure they even started the season, because I'm not sure the car was ready. I might be wrong about that, but I don't think it was there at the first maybe couple of races. And they still won the championship, despite the fact, and I can remember talking to Patrick Head about this, who was at Williams at the time, and one of the many, many... engineering big cheeses with other teams, who looked at this thing and just thought, oh, shit. And I can remember talking to Patrick Headley, and he said, actually, the 79, okay, it had an innovation on it, which we couldn't compete with, which is why I wanted, but it wasn't actually that great a car. Structurally, it wasn't very stiff. And so what that allowed him to do was to obviously design his own ground effect car, but to do it properly and have a really, really stiff monocoque. And that's why in 1979... when Lotus produced its successor, the Lotus 80, and everybody thought, well, that's just going to run away with it again. It didn't. It was a really poor car. So poor that they went back to using the 79. And in the meantime, you know, Patrick had designed the FW07, and the rest is history. Starts winning races, world championships, and, you know, Lotus never won another championship after that.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's I just find it interesting how... If you have an innovation like that, if you have one thing on your car, a kind of unfair advantage, then until everybody else has got it, then, you know, that might hold sway for you. But the moment they do, then if that's all you've got and the rest of the car ain't great, then you open yourself to the possibility that someone will just do a better job, which is exactly what Williams did, which is why Lotus had this extraordinary advantage, but never quite maximised what it could do.
Mm. Yeah, as a fan of modern Formula One, It is extraordinary to think back to these times where someone would turn up with a car that basically worked differently to everything else on the grid.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the biggest sort of points of difference we have now? Maybe, you know, a double diffuser in 2009, that sort of thing. Recently been innovations. Yeah, the Mercedes split compressor, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
But not a car that it fundamentally works differently to everything else. It must have been amazing to watch this thing turn up and just go, what is that?
I'm old enough that I did. I watched them at Brands Hatch.
Wow.
And they broke. But they were with these immensely long flowing side pods, which were absolutely core to what they did. They were just so beautiful. That's what I saw. I just saw beautiful racing cars. Beautiful, fast racing cars with guys like Mario Andretti and Ronnie Peterson driving them in their JPS livery. I mean, the Lotus 79 is the reason I started smoking, essentially. A JPS
you and many
Lotus
people.
79. Yeah, absolutely. no surprises which brand of cigarette I first started smoking when I was 78? I was probably 12. I mean, it's just shocking.
Bloody hell.
But, you know, that was the effect because you just identified with it and you wanted to, and the moment your mate started having a puff, you knew what brand you wanted to be pulling on. So, there you go. Oh, and actually, that's another thing. We haven't even mentioned the commercial side of it.
No.
Colin Chapman was the man who commercialised Formula One.
Yeah.
You know, we got with the Gold Leaf sponsorship of the 49 in the late 60s. He recognised that what Colin did more than anything else, what he did so brilliantly was multitasking. So he invented a thing, for instance, called the Chapman strut, which is a form of rear suspension. Mm. And it was so simple. It was just a strut, so a damper with a coil spring outside it. And then it used, well, what was so clever about it is it used the drive shaft. So it only worked at the back of the car. As the lower link of the suspension. So the drive shaft wasn't just turning the wheels, it was also forming an absolutely integral part of the suspension. Something like in the Lotus Elan, the dashboard was a structural element of the car. It also told you how fast you were going.
Yeah.
And again, in a very different but no less important and notable way, Colin realised that his cars, their aerodynamic surfaces, could be used not just for slipping through the air or providing downforce, but as advertising hoardings.
Mm. Same thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Same thing. It's multitasking. And it was just, I just find it so revealing of the man's mind. And just how fertile it was and how he never stopped thinking about doing things and thinking laterally and just stealing a march from everybody else.
And the point about multitasking, perhaps not in the case of sponsorship, is that if you've got one part doing two jobs, that's one fewer part that you need to stick to onto your car. And so it's lighter and simpler.
Exactly.
Which it is genius. It's such brilliant lateral thinking. It's just fantastic. And that is typical of the man. So we've barely mentioned the road cars. I mean, we're not going to get through all of them, obviously. But do we need to mention a couple? Maybe some of the sort of innovative ones. You did just mention the Elan.
His most innovative car, road car, was his first, the Elite, which was not just a full monocoque road car. It was a full, and to date, I believe the only fiberglass, monocoque road car.
Gosh, who thought that would be possible?
And why? And I'm afraid, I don't like asking questions on this podcast without being able to provide the answer, but I genuinely don't know. I guess it has to do with strength, but why is it also the most recent one? Why has no one else? Yeah. Someone will say that there's been some kit car that's done it, but I don't know, certainly from any recognisable mainstream manufacturer, of another car which ever had a glass fibre. I mean, you couldn't do it now because it wouldn't even look at passing any kind of crash test, but I don't know why. Why did Chapman abandon it?
Yeah.
You know, because his next road car, the replacement for the Elite, the Elan, which came out in 1962, had the sort of the backbone chassis, which went all the way through, right up to the V8 Esprit. They all just had backbone chassis with glass fibre bodies bonded to them. But yeah, I mean, just so clever. And the Alan. I think you do this. So Dan does this series on our website called I Have Never. And where you go and drive cars you've never driven. Really.
Yeah, well, the significant cars, yeah.
Yeah, so you need to go and drive an Alan.
Okay.
Yeah, you need to go and drive. You know, talk to Gordon Murray about the Alan, and his eyes just light up. Because it was a car that worked insofar as you could get in it and do a distance. So it wasn't completely and utterly uncivilized like a 7 was. But it was so light and it was so nimble and it was so quick, and it was just came along in 1962, and there was just nothing like it. And some would say that there has been nothing like it, and there are lots of people today who will tell you that the greatest road car that was ever produced was the Lotus Elan. So we definitely need to
good idea,
give that a shout out.
So what did we say at the start? He was no angel, Colin Chapman. And on this next point, we probably have to be quite careful about what we do and don't say. But you can't discuss Colin Chapman's life without mentioning the DeLorean scandal.
No, it was sad, really. Colin died at the back end of 1980. Was it 82?
It was
82. And I think it's a very, very sad end to the story, because at that time, you know, he'd just been through the whole Lotus 88 saga. This was his twin chassis Formula One car, which was, again, it was so, so clever. Every time I say this about the twin chassis car, someone gets in touch and goes, "You got it wrong." And I probably have. But nevertheless, the essential thing was, if you wanted ground effect to work really, really well, you had to have a completely rigid platform. Because otherwise, the ceiling wasn't properly done and the air surfaces were disturbed. But the problem with that was that basically meant the best car to provide that was a car with almost no suspension, which made it undrivable. So he did a car with two chassis, and the driver sat in one on top of another. So the driver was able to operate the car on because he had one chassis which was sprung, sitting on top of another which was massively more stiffly sprung. But although it practiced for a couple of races, it got slung out. The other thing about that car was it was the first carbon fiber Formula One car. People always say that it was the McLaren MP4-1. It wasn't. The MP4-1 was the first carbon fiber Formula One car to race. But the Lotus 88 was the first carbon fiber Formula One car, and it wasn't its fault that it didn't race. And the other thing was the McLaren got someone else to do that for them. They got a company called the Hercules Corporation in America to do it for them. Lotus did it all themselves in-house. And back to the point about, you know, getting onto the DeLorean thing. So he'd just been through all of that. The championship winning days were increasingly fading into the past. Clearly the 88 was never going to go anywhere. The recession of the early 1980s had absolutely mullered the road car business. The company was in terrible trouble. And I suspect that, like an awful lot of people put in that sort of situation, he found himself doing things which you hope otherwise he might not have done. And you're absolutely right. We do have to be careful about this. But what we know is that Lotus got involved. DeLorean, he designed this bonkers car, which didn't work. And so he went to Chapman and said, "Help." And Chapman redesigned the car, based it around, basically the internal, you know, the innards of an Esprit, and then put that stainless steel body on top of it. And the key point to remember is that DeLorean was being funded by the British government. Yeah. And so there was an awful lot of public money involved. DeLorean then got stung by the FBI, filmed trafficking, offering to sell vast amounts of cocaine to someone who turned out to be an FBI agent. So that was the end of DeLorean. Although, because it was entrapment, either the trial collapsed or it never even went to trial. So DeLorean was never tried by anything, but his reputation was completely torpedoed and that sort of thing. And then Chapman dies, and while they're sort of sifting through the wreckage of the whole DeLorean thing, they discover that Chapman is being paid by DeLorean through some Panamanian company. And I don't know the ins and the outs of it. What I do know is that the trial judge said if Chapman were around and been brought to trial, he would have likely have got 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's a sad, sad end.
Yeah.
If and so I just have to do this because when I was the editor of Motorsport 5,000 years ago, well, it wasn't quite that long ago, but it was the end of the 1990s. Somebody, a well-known motoring journalist, came to me with a story. He sent the story. I should have kept it, which basically proved, he said, that Chapman didn't die.
Oh, my God. Right, he just disappeared somewhere.
Caribbean.
Yeah.
And wow. he provided data to show that an aircraft had mysteriously left without filing a flight plan from the runway at Hethel. And apparently Chapman was on board it and he faked the whole thing because he knew the game was up and blah, blah. For the record, I don't believe a word of it. I didn't publish a word of it, but there are nevertheless, there are those, who, but then whenever anybody important, anybody interesting or important from, I mean, even Hitler, there are thousands of people who tell you that he, didn't yes. die. But no, you know, Chapman did not. And it's a sorry end to the story. You know, he was never tried, but you know, but it did taint his reputation, and you know, and for his son Clive, who now runs Classic Team Lotus, has been very kind to me and to us over the years, and is a you know thoroughly good bloke. It must be a bit uncomfortable to think how it, I think it, about a the fact he lost his father at such a young age. I think he was 54, and all the circumstances, not just the DeLorean stuff, but the fact that, you know, the race team wasn't at anything like its peak anymore. The road car business was in terrible trouble and so on and so on. It's a kind of sad end to what had been such a stellar career.
Mm. It is a sad end indeed. And we haven't explained the DeLorean thing in detail here, but there's so much about it online. You can just go and research it yourself if you want to know more. But it was Fred Bushell, the Lotus accountant, who supposedly masterminded the whole thing. And he did go down. He actually pleaded guilty and he did do time. Now, just final
there are,
point.
There are people who will tell you that Bushell took the rap for a lot of people.
Yeah, you read that.
And that he knew that, far as he was concerned, the game was up, and that he was in a position to, take the heat for a lot of other people. I don't know. I don't have an opinion. It's just another strange dimension to all that was going on at the time.
So final word on the DeLorean thing. I did an interview a couple of years ago. Last year, don't know, with former Williams F1 engineer Frank Durney. I did this for the Intercooler, and it's still available on the app and website. Just the story is called Finding His Flow. You can just search that and you'll find it. It's an interview with Frank Durney, and he recalls in 1982, he was sent on behalf of Williams to an FIA meeting in Paris. This is what he says. Everybody was there. There were three Formula One Constructors Association representatives, and I was one, a 32-year-old, very wet behind the ears engineer. The other two were Bernie and Colin Chapman. We were flying to Paris in Chapman's aeroplane. I'm sitting in the back just listening while Colin regales Bernie with stories about how clever his accountant, Fred Bushell, had been in doing deals with DeLorean. Maybe not quite clever enough. Deary me. Okay, so we're running out of time, but it occurred to me that neither one of us had ever met Colin Chapman.
No.
He died several years before I was born. But I thought that one of our writers presumably did spend some time with him, and I just wanted to get the thoughts, the impressions of somebody who at least met the bloke. And Mel Nichols did exactly that. I think he probably met him more than once. And Mel, thank you so much for sending these impressions across. I gave you next to no time to do this, but you've been very generous in sending across some impressions and also a very sort of revealing anecdote. So I'll just run through this quite quickly. Most of all, says Mel, what always struck you about Colin Chapman was his energy and urgency. It was obvious he had no time to waste. If you were talking, he got straight to the point, wasted no words, answered questions quickly, but showed his disdain if he lost interest and promptly turned his attention elsewhere. He was polite, even charming, if he had something he wanted or thought you were worth spending time on. You always knew at once that you were in the presence of a sharply intelligent man. He said he never saw him saunter. You know, he was always moving quickly. So the anecdote. I first met him in May 1974 when he introduced the new Lotus Elite to the press and took some of us out for a few laps around Hethel. It was a proud moment for him, but it would soon become embarrassing. The demo car was otherwise engaged, so he'd swiftly purloined the Elite assigned to Lotus's then chairman, Sir Leonard Crossland. He drove us being a couple of other journalists, swiftly out onto the track and immediately got into it, driving fast and smoothly. His style had become Lotus style. Into the last of three fast left-handers, just as he commented, a bit of reverse camber here, the Elite's rear broke away. Colin caught it nicely, it swung the other way, and he corrected that with a little less opposite lock, all perfectly done, showing us that his new car was a safe, pleasing handler, and why he'd been so good at his peak when he'd raced his own cars, as we discussed earlier. A little further on, at about 100 miles an hour down the straight, there was suddenly a loud ripping sound, followed by what seemed like something banging on the roof. "What the hell was that?" Colin said. After a bit of a debate, LJK Setright, one of the passengers, suggested correctly that the windscreen's top strip might have been torn loose by the air pressure. "It could be," said Colin. "With four up, the angle of incidence is more positive. But in that case, why has it never happened before?" It was a neat demonstration of his logical and analytical mind in action. And as the Elite, chrome strip flapping, drove back to the watching assembly of Lotus engineers, journalists and directors, including a mortified chairman, Crossland, horror froze the Lotus people's faces. Colin's scant tolerance for failure was well known. Some must have wondered if they'd still be employed at the end of the day. He got out, looked at the trim strip and said curtly to an engineer, "Make sure it never happens again." He carried on talking to us politely, but he was distracted and his mood far less chipper. We wondered what bollocking went on behind the scenes later.
Well, I think that says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It says, I mean, there is all of Chapman, from the car, the driver, the character. That's the man, isn't it?
Mm, indeed. Ah, goodness me. So he was awarded a CBE in the 1970 New Year's Honours for services to exports, actually, not to motor racing or anything else, but to exports. And it was on the 16th of December 1982 that he suffered a fatal heart attack. He left his wife, Hazel, two daughters and a son. I cannot get my head around the fact that he was 54 years old. When he died, only 54, and he achieved all of that in his life. That is extraordinary. That is a truly remarkable life, isn't it?
Yeah, a truly remarkable man.
Wow. So there you go. That's the story of Colin Chapman. I think that's quite a good thing to do, isn't it? Pick out a really significant individual and do a bit of a profile.
Yeah, we've done it before once or twice, and we'll do more. There's no shortage of them, is there?
No, not at all. So, we'll leave it there, but thank you everybody for listening. And if you want to nominate the next candidate for one of these sort of biography episodes, get in touch any way you like. We won't do a listener question this week because it's been a very full episode. But goodness me, I think it was a good one. Let us know what you think and tune in next week for another episode of the podcast.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.